Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. David Blight's Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, sheds new light on Douglass, circa 1818 to 1895, particularly the last 30 years of his life, thanks to a trove of letters, manuscripts, and scrapbooks in a private collection that no other historian previously used in any full-length biography. Blight writes that the collection, owned by Walter O. Evans of Savannah, Georgia, makes possible many new insights into the final third of Douglass's life. The younger Douglass, the heroic escaped slave and emerging abolitionist, is better known, in part because of the author's masterful first two autobiographies. The older Douglass, from Reconstruction to the end of his life in 1895, has never been so accessible or rendered so fascinating and complicated as in the Evans collection. In this lecture, held on June 2, 2019, in conjunction with the exhibition In the Library, Frederick Douglass Family Materials from the Walter O. Evans Collection, Blight shares how this material revealed the full extent of Douglass's complex personal life. Winner of the Pulitzer Prize for History in 2019, this biography masterfully weaves together the more popularly known story of Douglass's life of public activism with his perhaps lesser known private life to paint a complete portrait of the great American hero.
I had done a first book on Douglass back in 1989. It was a dissertation in graduate school. It was a somewhat narrow study of the meaning of the Civil War in Douglass's life. I'd gone on to write essays on Douglass, to edit editions of his first two autobiographies. I edited an edition of The Columbian Order, the magnificent book Douglass discovered as a 12-year-old and which changed his life. Brought that back into print, but I had put Douglass out of my life. And I was kind of good, that was good. He was gone. He's been part of some part, at least, of every other book I've ever written. But I had no intention of writing a full life of Douglass. That just wasn't on my horizon. Until 12 years ago, I went to Savannah to give a talk to middle school and high school teachers about Douglass's narrative, which they were teaching. I've done this many times. And my host was the Georgia Historical Society, and the wonderful people there said, there's a local gentleman here who's a collector, and he'd like to have lunch and would like to meet, and is that okay? And I don't know what I said. I probably said something like, yeah, I guess so. And after lunch that day, I knew I had met an extraordinary guy, and he took me over to his house, a big, beautiful, four-story brownstone on Jones Street, if you know Savannah, just two blocks off Forsyth Park. And Walter got out on his dining room table a portion of the Douglass collection, something like what you would see upstairs. The core of that collection are 9 or 10, I've sort of lost count, large family scrapbooks that were kept by, particularly by two of Douglass's sons, Lewis and Frederick Jr., over the last 30 to 35 years of their father's life. In fact, the scrapbooks kept the scrapbooks even after their father's death. When I first saw that collection, it was not one of those, destiny moments or some nonsense. I did not commit right away. This was too daunting. But with some time to think about it, I realized, if I don't do this, somebody else will. What an amazing collection. I was not the first to ever see Evans's and Walter's collection, but I was the first to really use it. Now, several other Douglass scholars and others have been there to use it. I spent many weeks in Savannah, several Yale spring break weeks, or 2 weeks. We have a 2-week spring break. Thank God, or I'd have never finished this book. I spent many, many weeks in Savannah working right there on the Evans's dining room table, which may be the coolest archive I've ever worked in, because you are surrounded in Walter's house with almost priceless works of African-American art, If you know the great landscape painter Duncanson, the dining room is lined with four Duncansons. When you enter the front door, there's a Romare Bearden on that wall and a Jacob Lawrence on that wall and an Edmonia Lewis statue right in front of you. And then it gets better from there. Even in the downstairs bathroom, there are a couple masterpieces on the wall. So that's why I did the book. And if you have the book, you'll note I dedicated it to Walter and Linda Evans. Now, upstairs you have a portion of that collection, which Walter has loaned here to the National Gallery. The catalog here is fantastic. The collection consists of so many different things. It's photographs, but that's not by any measure the most important stuff. Lots of family letters, about 30 or 40 letters by Lewis Douglas, the oldest son, to his sweetheart, courting letters to Amelia Logan over a period of years, and many of them from the front in the war when he was with the 54th Massachusetts. Those are amazing. Lots of manuscripts of Douglas's speeches, many of them in typescript, which may surprise you that the great Frederick Douglass was not just an orator who walked into halls and blew out the lights in some sermonic style. He wrote, all the great speeches are in text, some of them typescripts. But I'll just point to a couple other items, and they have them upstairs, which were to me, so precious to a biographer, you couldn't make it up. There are two narratives written by two of Douglass's sons, one by Fred Jr. and the other by Charles, that are with titles like Growing Up in the Douglass Household. And one of them was simply laying in a scrapbook, handwritten, loose. I can hardly believe it when I found it. And both of them are very revealing of their childhood, but especially about their mother. And as you may know, if you know your Frederick Douglass at all, one of the great enigmas in Douglass's story is trying to get to Anna Murray Douglass's story. Anna, his wife of 44 years, born free on the Eastern Shore, only about 3 miles from where he was born, follows him bravely out of slavery, risking the same thing he risked to follow this guy up to New York and then up to Massachusetts, but remained illiterate all of her life, and therefore we have nothing written by Anna. But when one gets these descriptions and reminiscences of their mother from the sons, those were precious. I think I quoted two-thirds of the words in those narratives at some point because you have so little on Anna. And that collection really was so important because it opened a window on, in so many different ways, onto the last third of Douglass's life. If Americans, or for that matter, anyone else in the world, know Douglass, they tend to know the young Douglass, the heroic Douglass, the Douglass of that first narrative in 1845, the Douglass who escapes slavery, who becomes a kind of instantaneous star of the anti-slavery movement as this incomparable orator. And then maybe they know about Douglass, the newspaper editor and the great spokesman of African Americans during the Civil War. But the last third of his life, the aging Douglass, the older patriarch, the patriarch of an extended family of four surviving adult children, 21 grandchildren, two or three fictive siblings that adopted him or he adopted them, and a whole variety of other hangers-on who were always there around Douglass, largely because they wanted money, that patriarch we don't know as well. It doesn't seem as heroic, and it may not be, but it's no less interesting. The Douglass of the later years, who gets three federal appointments, becomes a government bureaucrat, becomes a functionary within the Republican Party, although rarely inside the circles of real power. But he holds these three important federal positions: Marshal of the District of Columbia, Recorder of Deeds in the District, and then eventually the U.S. Minister to Haiti under President Harrison, 1889 to 91. The Evans Collection opens up windows onto all of that in ways we didn't have before. And remarkably, what the collection has is literally thousands of newspaper clippings. You'll only see a portion upstairs. The sons just started clipping newspapers and pasting them into these scrapbooks, and then eventually, somewhere in the 1880s, they hired a clipping service, which I didn't even know existed in the 19th century. It was called the American Bureau. And a lot of the clippings have at the top the insignia of the American Bureau. So wherever the old man went, or Douglas went, on these endless, endless speaking tours, there'd be clippings from all kinds of small towns, which for the biographer give you texture, give you little stories, give you moments that you can use, anecdotes. The biographer is always looking for the anecdote that illuminates. Give you one example. There's so many clippings in the Evans collection that I could point to for how precious they were to me. He's on another, when was it? It was in the 80s, I forget the year. But I remember where he was. He was in Iowa City in the winter. And he's in the middle of another one of these 3 to 4 month back-breaking tours all over the Midwest. They were always in the winter, because you didn't do speaking tours in the summer because it's farming season. You go in the winter when the farmers aren't busy, and they come out to all the Chautauqua talks, and you get $100 a pop. Sometimes you get $150. But he's sitting in a train station in Iowa City, waiting for the train to the next place. And there's a reporter, and he always had reporters following him by then, and the reporter was from a Milwaukee newspaper. Don't ask me why a Milwaukee reporter was following Douglas in Iowa, but he was. And the reporter says to him, Mr. Douglas, last night you didn't seem to have it. You just weren't hitting it. And in effect, that's what he's saying. It just didn't seem to be your usual powerful self and voice. And Douglas says, yeah, well, you know, I can't belt it out like I used to because I have false teeth now and my teeth will fly out. But that wasn't the best part. I used that, you can be sure. But then the reporter asked him, so what's the hardest part of being on all these lecture tours like this? And Douglas's answer was, having to speak to guys like you. And I thought, yes! Even if that reporter made it up, that was real. All kinds of anecdotes like that. I could go on and on. I won't. One other little point. In the book, I call the Douglas extended family the Black First Family of Washington, D.C. They all moved here in the wake of the fire that burned Douglas's house in Rochester in 1872. Probably arson. Incredibly destructive moment in his life and the life of his family. None of them were hurt, but they lost a lot. Anyway, they all moved to D.C. They first lived up on F Street, and then eventually, by 1878, he buys Cedar Hill with a $6,000 loan from Robert Purvis, a friend of his in Philadelphia. But eventually, because Washington, D.C. had so many newspapers, and at least 3 or 4 of them black newspapers, and at least one, if not two of those, basically tabloid scandal sheets, Douglas's extended family became the Black First Family of Washington. And everything they did, good, bad, and ugly, got into the press. If they had a bankruptcy, it's in the press. If they got sued, it's in the press. If they lost a job, it's in the press. Or when his son-in-law, Nathan Sprague, who married Rosetta, their daughter, sues his grandfather. Oh, did that get into the press? Ugly. Or when Douglas becomes recorder of deeds and gets 8 appointments as clerks in the recorder's office, who does he appoint first? His 4 adult children. Nepotism, nepotism, nepotism. He's accused of nepotism. It's headlines in the paper. And finally, Douglas had to respond and said, yeah, well, my kids need jobs. Thank you. But Douglas took some heat for everything he did, every speech he gave. He learned what it meant now to be famous. And fame became, they didn't call it celebrity in the 19th century, fame became a huge problem in Douglass's life. It had its pleasures, but it had its perils. And again, the Evans collection opened that up to me. I could go on and on. Now, I just want to run through as quick as I can what every biographer, I think, does. I imposed order onto a very long, epic, extraordinary life. How do you organize a life of 77 years across much of the 19th century? How do you organize telling the story of a man who's born a slave in a backwater of the American slave society out on the sandy soil of the eastern shore of Maryland, born along a horseshoe bend in the Tuckahoe River, really nowhere and nobody, never knew who his father really was, barely knew his mother and had to invent images of her, was in every sense an orphan. How do you tell this story of a kid born out there, a slave, who spends 9 of his 20 years as a slave on the Eastern Shore, and some of those as a brutalized field hand, but then spends, to his great good fortune, 11 years in Baltimore, and without Baltimore, we wouldn't even know Douglass. Without what Douglass called his Baltimore dreams. It was that city of Baltimore, the maritime port, with its window onto the world's commerce and the world's shipping industry, and those gallant ships. And it was that Baltimore of the free black community that gave Douglass an imagination, helped him cultivate his literacy, which became the most precious power he owned, and indeed the only real power he ever had. The four churches he got involved in, two of them predominantly black, two predominantly white. The city in which he meets Anna, his fiancée, probably when he was 18 years old, and made a certain array of friends, most of them in the free black community. How do you begin to resurrect that life when most of what you can know about it comes from his own pen, not all of it? And by the way, that free black community was so important to him. And the year he escaped, 1838, Baltimore had about 3,000 slaves. A total population of 120 or 130,000. Baltimore was a huge city then, a huge port, a great ocean port. I mean, it still is. Have 130,000 people. It had 3,000 slaves, but it had 17,000 free blacks. It's a vibrant community. They live a circumscribed life legally and politically in lots of ways. But he gets very involved in that community, and it has everything to do with how he evolves, gains an imagination, dreams his way out, and indeed gets out. But then how do you explain this kid from nowhere, who by the age of 23 is out on the anti-slavery circuit, taking it by storm as a young orator, his favorite subject of which was religious hypocrisy? He'd been practicing that theme ever since he was a teenage orator out on the Eastern Shore. But then how do you explain how he becomes this most sought-after, extraordinary voice of political abolitionism in the 1850s, when he edits his own newspaper and he masters that short-form political editorial, when he evolves into a real political thinker and a political radical, when he begins to shoulder up to violence and possible uses of violence, and he begins to adopt the anti-slavery interpretation of the Constitution, and he believes in political action and political parties, and you're not even to the Civil War yet. And then how do you make sense of what the Civil War meant in the life of this most important black spokesman of his family, his people, his country? His entire family went to war. Charles and Lewis enlisted at age 20 and 19. And if I ever had Douglass in that room, I always dream of, every biographer dreams of having your subject in a room, a seminar room, with the doors locked. He can't get out. And I and maybe three or four other Douglas scholars, we get to have maybe 4 hours, 6 hours, no bathroom breaks. He's got to sit there and we get to have at him all the questions we want to ask that he never told us about. Especially in those 1,200 pages of autobiography, he never talks about his family. There's one mention of his wife, Anna, and she's called my wife. Ugh. But one of my questions is going to be, and every time I ask it to him, he slithers out of the room somehow. Mr. Douglas, what does a father say to his two sons who are 20 and 19 when he recruits them into an army where they can be not only killed but enslaved? Did they go to war for their reasons or your reasons or both? Or do you even know? What did you say to them? He didn't tell us. He just told us how proud he was. Well, I got a lot of other questions I want to ask him. One would be, Mr. Douglas, Anna, explain. But how do you make sense of this epic life where after the Civil War he becomes this former radical, this radical outsider, who becomes now a political insider, who gets inside of power a little bit, who gets to have some kind of influence and wants even more and wants to get to the center of power, who has to become that kind of political operative who makes a few deals and compromises with his own ideology and earns a lot of criticism and rivalries with the next generation. I don't know. How do you impose order on it? Here's the way I imposed order. I organized the book around six big themes, and I'll just state them for you. The first is words. Any biography of Frederick Douglass is the biography of words. You wouldn't be here right now. We wouldn't be here talking about this if it weren't for the millions of words that he wrote and spoke. 1,200 pages of autobiography, hundreds and hundreds of the short-form political editorials, one novella in 1852, and would that he'd tried fiction even more. He's actually a pretty good fiction writer, as you may detect in his autobiographies at times. Just at times. And then there are the thousands of speeches. And as I said, all the great speeches are in text. And by the way, when you do biography and you spend all these years with somebody, there's some things you never can really know, and it drives you crazy, and they're always going to be elusive. You know, come on, I want to know more about this, and you didn't tell us, and I can't find it. But there's some things you also do know. And among my list, on my list of things I do know, is that Douglas, like maybe some of you and some of us, was a person who didn't really know what he thought until he could write it down. When there was a crisis, when there was a big event, which is all the time in his life, he would go to his desk. There's a big turn, a big pivot, a big moment. He'd go to his desk. And sometimes it would come out in an editorial, or an essay, or sometimes it would come out in a speech. And he figured out what he thought by writing. He was a writer, and a great writer. So words are a major theme. I weave it throughout the book. Even when I'm talking about his early youth as a slave, I'm using his words a lot of the time. So the ways he finds through metaphors and remembrance to characterize the meaning of slavery in his psyche, in his soul, and on his body comes through words. At one point in writing this book, I told my editor, Simon & Schuster, Bob Bender, whom I love, even though he tells me where to get off at times, I said, I got a title, Bob. Yeah? Yeah? But I said, well, I want to call it Frederick Douglass, Biography of a Voice. Bob said, nope. Too literary. You'll lose your audience. And he was probably right. But it is the biography of a voice. I didn't call it that. The second big theme is the autobiographies. And this goes without saying, maybe, but just one quick point. In Douglass's case, because he wrote three autobiographies and then revised the third one into a fourth one 11 years after the 1881 edition, The autobiographies are always a source. They are, and they're an incredible source of aspects of his life. But they also are your subject. You have to keep trying to explain and understand, why does this guy keep writing his own story over and over and over? What is it about him that he seems to believe he has this one story to tell and he has to keep doing it? Is it because of his sense of representativeness? He has to be this spokesman of Black America, that he has to represent this slavery story, that that's his obligation of his life? Or are there so many aspects in those autobiographies that show us he just needed to keep searching for who the hell he was? How does a nobody kid from the Tuckahoe on that side of the Chesapeake get to this side of the Chesapeake, living up on that hill and advising presidents down on Pennsylvania Avenue? How did I get from there to here? That's a question he never could fully explain, but never stopped trying. And third big theme, to put it bluntly, is the Bible. I'm not the first scholar to treat seriously how Douglass thought about the Bible or how he used it, but I think I've gone further than anybody else, and I'm still waiting for a review of this book by a serious theologian who's going to take me to the shed. I'm still waiting. If you're one of them, don't tell me yet, because I'm still having a good ride here. So. But Douglass was deeply steeped in the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, and you have to explain that. Comes by this, of course, in his youth. He's first taught to read by Sophia Auld, his mistress in Baltimore, for a year, year and a half. She reads the Bible out loud with him. He ends up reading the Bible out loud with an old Black preacher in Baltimore named Charles Lawson, whom he called Uncle Lawson and Father Lawson. He loved old Lawson. Lawson was a Bible fanatic, although not a real good reader. And when he found this kid, Douglass, who could read so well, he just sat him down an hour, by the hours they would read the Old Testament together. Douglass got language in his head through the King James cadences of the Bible. And he eventually sort of ingested so many of the book's stories, especially Old Testament stories, that he then would make his own. The Exodus story in particular, but many, many, many others. There is no major Douglass speech without references to the Bible, quotes from the Bible, paraphrases from the Bible, sometimes seemingly only throwaway lines. And thanks to Google now, you see a line you think might be biblical, you punch it in and it'll take you somewhere. Google's not always right, but it's a help. Anyway, I had terrible confidence issues about this question of how to treat it, because I had no formal training in theology. I took a couple religion history courses as an undergrad. I've always been interested in this. But I have theologian friends who were a great help to me, and I like to mention them and give them credit, at least two of them. Jim Ponet, who was a head rabbi at Yale for years and years, retired from his job and used to come and sit in on classes. And he and his wife, Alana, used to sit in the front row of my lecture class. And we got to know each other, and he got to understand my dilemmas about Douglass. And finally, one day, Jim took me aside and said, "All right, David, here's what you got to do. You got to read Robert Alter. You got to read so-and-so. You got to read so-and-so. You got to read James Darby. But go read Abraham Heschel, the book called The Prophets, among others." He said, "Look, Heschel wrote 38 books, but make sure you start with this one." And I did. And it was in reading Heschel that I finally got somewhat comfortable with using that word prophet. You shouldn't put prophet in the title of your book unless you're prepared to defend it. That's a big word. And we sometimes throw it around a little too easily. You know, she prophesied this or prophesied that. Prophets don't predict. That's not why they're important. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. Here's what Heschel said. I quote Heschel three or four times in the book. "The prophet is human," said Abraham Heschel. "Yet he employs notes one octave too high for our ears. He experiences moments that defy our understanding. He is neither a singing saint nor a moralizing poet, but an assaulter of our minds. Often his words begin to burn where our conscience ends. An assaulter of the mind. A prophet is that person who can find the words, sometimes in an octave we don't entirely hear or understand at first, to explain a catastrophe, a tragedy, a great triumph, a pivot in history, a dilemma, a world significant event that no one else can quite explain. And the prophet is also that person who sometimes just issues us warnings we don't want to hear. Prophets are usually not people who are nice and that you just want to have lunch with. It won't be fun. Prophets are the people we don't want to have to listen to. We walk away from them. Don't remind me of my sins. Don't remind me of how I poisoned my society. Don't remind me of my hypocrisy. My hypocrisy's mine. Don't mess with it. You know. More and more I read Heschel, I kept saying, that's Douglas. That's Douglas. And if you read Douglas with any care, go read a couple speeches. Read the narrative. Read Bondage and Freedom, the second autobiography, which is his long-form masterpiece. It's a much more political autobiography. You will start reading passages that just blast you between the eyes, and you think, oh my goodness, I hadn't thought about it that way. I can still read Douglas all the time. I was speaking yesterday to the Yale alumni reunion, and one person asked, in doing all this new book on Douglas, what surprised you? And I said, well, lots of things, but especially every time I read Douglas, I see something new. And I always wonder, why didn't I use that passage? Why didn't I quote that? Or maybe I did, I don't know. My other theological helper was Don Shriver. And I want to give these people credit. Don used to be president of Union Theological Seminary in New York City. He's a great Protestant theologian, Presbyterian by roots, North Carolina by roots. He was born and raised and steeped in the lost cause tradition of the South. But he read his way out of it and got educated out of it, and he's now this brilliant aging man who's not in good health. But one day I called up Don. I said, help me understand what he's doing here with the Old Testament. Don invited me down to New York, said, meet me for lunch. We met for lunch, and he did the same thing. After he finished laughing when I asked, what do I read on the Old Testament? You know. He said, all right, you got to read so-and-so and so-and-so, but read Walter Brueggemann. And I read Walter Brueggemann. And Brueggemann really helped me get my head around what the primary Hebrew prophets were really about and helped me grasp the thousand uses of the Exodus story that Americans have engaged in. Anyway, I finally got the confidence to put that word prophet in the title, and so far I've gotten away with it. Last but not least, the last four big themes, and I'll do these quickly. I've already mentioned two of them. The first is this crooked path from the radical outsider, the old abolitionist, who's always on the outside, beating on the doors, trying to get inside of power, who becomes the political insider after the Civil War. If you think about it, how many radical reformers in history lived to see their cause win in the middle of their life? He's only in his 40s at the time of the war and emancipation. He's going to live till 77. What happens in that 30 years after the victory? How do you hold on to that victory? In fact, in the third autobiography, the chapter about the ending of the war, and of course he's writing this in retrospect, Douglas calls, in Life and Times, he calls it vast changes. And the opening paragraph of that is worth reading. Well, the whole thing's worth reading, but he begins by saying, well, you know, the war was over, Lincoln was dead, but I seem to have lost my community. He says, my congregation was gone. What will I do now? Will I have any relevance? Will anyone want to hear from me anymore? How will I make a living? And he ends that opening paragraph of that chapter with he just draws a line from Shakespeare, which he did all the time. It comes right out of Othello's soliloquy, and it just says, he says, Othello's occupation is gone. I have no purpose. I have no status. I've lost it all. That wasn't true. It turned out he was in total demand all the time, although it wasn't going to be easy to make a living for a while. Anyway, that's a theme I weave throughout. Fifth big theme, which is true of almost any biography, at least I think it should be, is how you find the balance between the public and the private person. That's always one of the most difficult tasks in biography, even for those people who left lots of diaries or... My colleague John Gaddis did a famous Pulitzer-winning biography of George Kennan. Maybe some of you have read it. George Kennan, before he died in his 90s, gave John his recordings of his dreams. No one gave me Douglas's recordings of his dreams. Now, if you know about it, you should have told me 2 or 3 years ago. How do you balance public and private? Well, first of all, you don't do any chapters that are just labeled private life, second wife. Yeah, no. You got to fold it. Or you don't do any chapters that are just the public life. You have to weave it all together because that's the way we live life. People who have a public life or a highly involved professional life live both sides of that every day. So did he, in real time. So it's not cordoned off. One is not cordoned off in a chapter here and a chapter there. The attempt is to weave it all together at once, for better or for worse. And there's a lot to weave. That massive extended family. Complicated, sometimes messy, but loving relationships with his adult children. Incredible letters with his daughter Rosetta, who had the best education of all the kids. 2 marriages, one of 44 years to Anna, one of 11 years to Helen Pitts, whom he married a year and a half after Anna died. The most scandalous marriage of the 19th century, by the way. And oh God, the Evans collection has almost an entire scrapbook full of clippings just about the marriage to Helen. There was so much press coverage of that for months. And they just took it, said, thank you very much. I'll marry who I wish. I don't know what he said in private. At times he must have been cursing some people who had cursed him. But the most famous black man in the world married a white woman 20 years younger. That would probably be somewhat controversial now, I suspect. And you can bet that it was in 1884. Oh dear, was it. And last but not least, a sixth big theme, and it's got to be there with Mr. D, is Douglas the intellectual, the artist, the writer, the thinker. And for years now, he's been treated not just as the heroic runaway slave, not just as a booming orator, but as a serious thinker about everything from the nature of the Constitution and American legal traditions to political theory. There are no less than 3 books now, there may be a 4th out already, on Douglas as a political thinker, particularly as an advocate of the natural rights tradition. There are no less than 2 collections of essays on Douglas as a constitutional thinker by law school professors. Some of us have written a good deal about Douglas and the idea of memory, of historical memory and personal memory. And he's been studied by literary critics almost into dust ever since the 1970s, when it was a rite of passage in black literary criticism that you had to write your essay on Douglas's narrative or you couldn't be considered for tenure or whatever. And then as a journalist, he's one of the great 19th century journalists who took that element of modernity called the rotary press and made a life with it. So there's my 6 big themes that I hang the book on. Now, I want to just give you one last example of how Douglas, in moments when he needed a story, and there's so many of these, I'll just cite one, when he needed a story and would go to the Bible, because in part he knew his audience understood its Bible. And by the way, in the book, I deal far less with Douglas's actual faith, because that's not as accessible, than I do with Douglas as a biblical storyteller. Go with me quickly to 1864. It's the election year. Middle of the Civil War. The United States is going to try to hold a general election. And early on in the campaign, from spring and early summer of 1864, the war, of course, was in terrible stalemate. It's going to be in terrible stalemate by summer in the Overland Campaign in Virginia, eventually the Siege of Petersburg. It's going to be in terrible stalemate in front of Atlanta. Sherman has invaded Georgia and has finally made it to Atlanta, but Atlanta still holds. Sheridan's big campaigns down the Shenandoah Valley have not happened yet. And Admiral Farragut has not yet taken Mobile Bay. Lincoln has every right to think that he would not be reelected. The sheer scale of war weariness across the North was terrible. The casualty list out of Virginia in particular, ghastly. The Democrats are running George B. McClellan for president, the former general who Lincoln had fired. There's every reason to believe, from their rhetoric at least, that the Democrats, if elected, would probably negotiate some kind of settlement with the South, a peace of some kind. And out of that, who knows what the nature of the Union would be, and particularly who knows what's going to happen to slavery. And don't forget, by now, the Emancipation Proclamation is a year and a half old. It's been in operation, for better or worse, since January 1863. That campaign was, as I always tell students, the most racist in American history until the next one, because 1868 got even worse. But in this campaign, the Democrats painted Lincoln as an N-word lover. They painted the Republicans as N-word lovers. They painted the Republicans as the party of emancipation. They just wrote emancipation across the forehead of every Republican in the land. They called Lincoln Abraham Africanus the First, implying that he was really black. They put out these fiction cartoons about Republicans holding what were called miscegenation balls in New York and other cities. In fact, they even invented the word miscegenation, mixing of the races, in that campaign. That word had never been in parlance before. It was a brutally white supremacist campaign by the Democrats, and it put the Republicans back on their heels, trying to kind of, you know, be the party of emancipation, but not look like it. We see this in our politics all the time. It's a wedge. It's the classic wedge issue. If you want to beat the Republicans in 64, tar them with emancipation. And boy, did they ever. In August, Lincoln called Douglas to the White House. It's their second meeting. The first time a year earlier, in August of 63, Douglas came on his own. He didn't have any invitation. He went that time to protest the discriminations against black soldiers. And as Douglas put it, as we put it these days, you know, they had a good diplomatic exchange of ideas, but didn't agree on much. But in 64 now, believing he might indeed not be reelected in November, Lincoln invites Douglas to the White House for a formal meeting. The greatest black spokesman in the country, Lincoln now decides he needs him. But what he did is he asked Douglas, among other things, to become overnight the principal agent of a scheme to funnel as many slaves out of the Upper South as possible before Election Day. He wanted Douglas to go back to Rochester and start sending out telegrams and letters to his abolitionist friends, and particularly the people who had been involved in recruiting black soldiers, and organize a scheme with the War Department. That's all he was told. No one ever gave him any blueprint as to how in the hell he was supposed to do this. But go organize a scheme to funnel as many slaves out of the South before Election Day, in case Lincoln is not reelected, and therefore large numbers of slaves, the theory was, would be under some kind of legal freedom before the Democrats got into power. Douglas was stunned. In fact, I don't think Douglas had a clue how the hell he was supposed to do this. He said, he took a gulp and apparently said, sure, and went back to Rochester, and for almost 2 weeks he's sending out telegrams and letters asking people to get involved in this scheme. He can't give them much sense of how that's going to be done. And then he was saved, of course, by the fall of Atlanta, first week of September. Even earlier, on August 25th, Admiral Farragut took Mobile Bay in the largest, biggest naval battle of the Civil War, a huge turning point. Sheridan's campaign down the valley happens in September. And Northern morale turned. There isn't any doubt about it. It now looked like, especially with the fall of Atlanta, the war can be won. It can be prosecuted to an end. What does Douglas do? Well, he wanted to campaign for Lincoln, and the Republican Party wouldn't let him. You're being tarred as the party of emancipation. You don't put the black guy out there. And they wouldn't let him go campaign. So he sucked it up and he said, okay. But he gave a barn burner of a campaign speech at a black convention in Syracuse, which is one of his great speeches. And then on election night, and I got this evidence from the Evans collection. I only have one clipping of it, but boy, I went with it. He's in Rochester on election night. And in the Evans collection, in one little article in a Rochester newspaper that the boys pasted in from like 1881, there's a reminiscence of a guy living in Rochester whose name I can't recall. But he remembered being the poll worker that put Frederick Douglass's ballot into the box that night in Rochester in November 1864. And furthermore, he said, I lived near the Douglasses, and I walked back into the middle of town. Douglas lived almost a mile from the center of town. He says, I was walking back into town that night with Mr. Douglas to go to the telegraph office to hear the returns of the election. And he says, a group of four drunken white thugs came out of an alleyway in Rochester and challenged Douglas, you know, to a fight. And according to this witness, Douglas put up his fist, which he had done before. Douglas had fought with his fist before. Douglas put up his fist, and the drunken thugs, according to this witness, just scurried off back into their hole. And this guy says, well, Douglas had won both a physical and a political victory. Well, okay. They go to the telegraph office, and they learned that Lincoln had been elected with 55% of the vote. But it's what he does next. On that Sunday, the Sunday after the election, Douglas went where he had spoken so many times before, to the Spring Street AME Church in Rochester, black church. He could have that pulpit anytime he wanted, especially Sunday afternoons. He had given whole lecture series there over the years. He'd pick a theme and speak six times on a theme, week after week. He went to Spring Street the Sunday after the election, packed house. He got up, and how does he begin? He begins with the story of Noah's Ark. Now, you might be thinking, what? Noah's Ark. And he knew his audience would know it. He said, you know, the ark stopped, finally. And Noah wondered. And Noah sent a dove out of the ark. And the dove returned and had an olive branch in his beak. So Noah wondered more. Could it be? Could it be? And he sends the dove out again. And the dove does not return. And so Noah decided to take the tarp off the ark. And lo, the world was being renewed. The flood was over. That's the oldest rebirth metaphor in Western civilization, in Genesis. When he needed a story or a metaphor to place his audience in to understand what was happening to them, this is Douglas the prophet. But he didn't stop there. He announced in that speech that the following week, he was going down to Baltimore for the first time since he escaped in 1838. He'd never been back. And the reason he's going back, he announced, is the state of Maryland had just had a referendum on November 1st to vote whether to become a free state. And Maryland had voted narrowly. It was like 12,300 and some votes to 12,100. It was like ridiculously close. But Maryland had voted to be free. So Douglas said, I'm returning to the free soil of Maryland next week. And he did. He journeyed back to Baltimore. He had paparazzi in tow, or press, covering this. And that's one of the reasons we know the details. And where does he go? He goes to Fells Point, where he had lived and escaped from. He went to Dallas Street, to the Bethel AME Church, one of the churches he had sort of grown up in. Packed house again. At the front steps, he encountered a woman, a bit older than him, a black woman, who announced herself as his sister, Eliza. He hadn't seen her since 1836. She lived down in the southern tip of the Eastern Shore. She had come some 80 miles or so to Baltimore because she heard her famous brother was going to be there. She took him by the arm, and he took her by the arm. I don't even know if he recognized her, but I hope he did. Hello, Frederick, I'm Eliza. Eliza, by the way, had bought her own freedom in the late 1850s. She'd had 8 children and named one of them for her famous brother, Frederick Douglass Mitchell. He took her by the arm. They walked arm in arm up the main aisle of the church. At the front of the church, we're told, the pulpit was surrounded by American flags. And Douglas got up, did the same thing he'd done in Rochester, told the Noah story. Noah sends the dove out. Dove comes back, olive branch in the beak. Noah sends the dove out again. No dove returns. Tarp. Lo, the world is remade. But then Douglas said, and think of the chutzpah to do this. He said, but today I am the dove. I am the sign that I have returned the former slave to the free soil of Maryland. I am the dove. Again, the chutzpah to put yourself in the Noah's Ark story and get away with it? I mean, God, that's a prophet. It's when you see it in the language, when you see him doing it, feel him doing it, read him doing it, you begin to understand this was a special prophetic voice. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.